If a person, there can be wrong effort, and there can be an imbalance of effort, where effort is too striving or pushing or demanding or straining. And that's not helpful either. And I think one of the reasons why often in the West, there's a very the rhetoric of meditation is often somewhat passive, is because a lot of Westerners tend to be very active and inclined to begin with. They're overly energizing, striving and pushing. And so it's an antidote to that striving, that pushing. But we can go too far in the passive direction. And there's an active part too. And I think when meditation is very mature, that the active and the receptive are balanced together, both there equally. It's not one or the other. Yes?
I found most of my meditations pretty much the same. And some of those factors, like, hardly happened at all. But by keeping those questions kind of in my mind, so that I could remember it after the meditation, it helped me be more awake, more alert.
Great. So it helped her in keeping these things in mind, even though she didn't see much variation, helped her be much more alert. And that's, you know, one of the key things we're trying to do is to develop a heightened sense of alertness. And being vigilant, having something to be looking at and tracking, is one of the ways of developing that. Yeah.
When I tried tracking all the different factors, I found it really confusing. So I kind of settled on two of them, you know, calmness and alertness. And so tracking those two made it very easy to remember all the others afterwards for me.
Oh, great. Beautiful.
I'm just not sure how to relate to motivation. You know, every time I thought about that, I wasn't sure what that was.
Uh-huh.
And I think I confused it a little bit.
The effort. They're related to each other. A motivation is the same, maybe similar to resolve. How motivated are you to do the practice when you sit down to meditate? If you knew that you were going to, you know, die tomorrow, or if you knew that you had some horrible illness and the meditation was the only thing that was going to help you, if you did it intently, you'd be really motivated. You sit down, and you might spoil it because you're so motivated, you know, and get tense, but you'd be really motivated. Whereas if you think, well, I'll get enlightened eventually, and I have a lot of faith in this practice, and I've been told it's good to sit, and well, just, whatever happens is fine. You're supposed to accept everything they tell me, so I'll just accept everything, there isn't resolve. Okay, this is what I'm doing, and what you can notice is over different sittings, the degree of motivation resolve can vary quite dramatically. I mean, you know, I did this thing also myself, and there was one day there was, I think I had like a 7 for the resolve, and I think the next day I had a 2 and a 3, you know. So it's interesting to see that and note that, and when you notice that there's a variation in degree of these things, then the question becomes what is a healthy, wise way that you can perhaps increase the degree of these things. If you notice that your motivation is kind of low compared to what it's been some other times, are there ways that you can then muster up greater motivation and resolve for your sitting?
The first thing is I didn't know exactly where to start. 1 to 10 on what kind of scale, and completely scattered and completely as concentrated as you are.
As the Buddha.
So where am I on the scale? So I found what happened is that I put down the series of numbers almost arbitrarily and then started comparing the first numbers.
I understand that. So it might be that after 7 days of doing it, you want to go back and revise the whole thing because your standard should be different. And you thought you knew what 10 was like, but then you get to, you know, you got to the fifth day and wow, that what I call 10 before is really just a 3. I didn't know it could be that strong. And I better go back and revise. Anyway, so I think your point is well taken that it's a little bit arbitrary at first. You don't have any?
The other thing was that things like motivation seem to be, motivation and effort seem to happen before rather than during. Once I'm on the cushion, sort of like I'm there, it's the play, okay, fine, what can I do to get up? before the 45 minutes is over or something like that. So those factors seem to come in before rather than during.
Oh, so you bring those factors with you to the cushion, and whatever you brought with you, you're stuck with for the 45 minutes.
No. The effort is to get onto the cushion.
Yeah.
Once I'm there, no additional effort is needed. All I have to do is be present.
But there's effort to be present, isn't there?
No, you're always present. You just don't know that.
You don't know? It's true. Other comments? Yes, please.
I found the categories were really very helpful just to review before I would sit. And the one that I thought was most curious, at least for me, was enjoyment. And each time I looked at that, I thought, wow, am I enjoying this? I guess I am. And that itself is something of a revelation.
You're allowed to enjoy it. And not only that, to some degree, as practice matures, you're expected to enjoy it. Expected to have joy as part of it. And so by very, innocently or, without expectation or demand or measuring yourself, keeping an eye out to notice the joy which is there can be work almost like a biofeedback kind of loop that helps you, motivate you to keep practicing and keep on track. And the joy can be real help in the practice. Enjoyment. Yes?
Several times where it's like nothing was coming up. You know, I wasn't getting distracted. I wasn't having any, emotional sadness or anything come up. But I noticed afterwards that I was a lot calmer in the real world. You know, but it was just kind of like, well, is this doing anything? I'm just sitting here. You know, it wasn't like...
Nothing. There seems to be various ways in which meditation can work for people. Maybe different people at different times or different kinds of people. And some people report that nothing seems to happen to them in meditation. Nothing, they don't notice anything. The mind wanders a lot and thinks a lot. And they're trying to be present a little bit. But over the months and years, they don't really notice much change. However, they notice a big change in their daily life. And somehow, they don't see the change in the sitting, but somehow by doing the sitting, it affects their daily life in a big time way. There are other people for whom they have dramatics like spiritual Disneyland. They sit down and it's like these amazing things happen. And some of those people, they leave their meditation session and they're kind of jerks. nothing has happened. it doesn't really help them. And there are some people for whom there are really things that happen in meditation itself that really then see very direct correlation to how it affects their daily life. And so there's all different ways it works. And we don't want to have just one model of this is the way it has to be. Different minds, unfold in different ways. Yes?
I found it really helpful to track the hindrances for myself because ordinarily I pay attention to how calm I am and how motivated I am. That's not too hard for me to see, but the hindrances were really interesting. And I found that when I came out of the meditation, I would then think about getting to the bottom of some of those hindrances. It just caused me to focus more on why they're there.
Great.
And try to figure out the source of them.
Do you notice any patterns in which hindrances are your common visitors?
Definitely.
And then if you notice that, then you can also not only kind of get to the root of them after meditation and grapple with them, but also begin to develop the skills of how to work with them in meditation so they're no longer hindering you. Well, I will today as we go on, but for example, if desire is a common hindrance, then after a while, maybe you learn that whenever desire arises, you learn to recognize it immediately because you've become familiar with it. And also, you maybe begin to recognize how it feels in your body. So whenever desire comes, you turn immediately to the felt sense feeling of desiring in the body, as opposed to just going along with the fantasy that's associated with it. So you have a skill, turning towards it. Or maybe you have a skill and bring an antidote. You have some antidote that you bring. So, okay, if there's desire, maybe you think about the antidote. There's a number of antidotes for desire. The most graphic one is to think of the impure aspects of the human body. The so-called, those parts of the human, those those parts and fluids of the human body which you would rather not have on your pillow at night when you go to sleep. Which, in shorthand, in the old tradition, is called the impure aspects of the body. We just, you know, we don't want to use that word, right? Nothing's impure. But we wouldn't want it in our pillow. So anyway, I didn't say it very well, but there's skills to be developed in relationship to the hindrances. So you're not just kind of coasting along with them. You know, they're just there kind of running the show, but you're beginning to take some charge and getting some mastery over them. Now, in the ancient world, and if you read the ancient texts, people doing the Buddhist texts, there's a lot of emphasis on developing mastery. You're becoming a master of your own mind, mastering the mind, having some control over the mind, so that the mind is not just simply wandering freely wherever it goes, and you're kind of tracking and aware of where it goes. You're very mindful, but your mindfulness is like, you know, you're like this puppy dog that's being pulled, you know, or like, I don't know like what, but you're being pulled along wherever the mind wants to go. Then you're not in charge. There's a lot of emphasis on developing mastery over the mind itself. And today's topic is going to be what's called the five faculties, which involves very much these elements of mastery. So some of the elements of mastery. But before I go into that, before you start taking notes about the five faculties, what I'd like to try to do, this, you have to realize this whole intermediate class is an experiment at this point, learning how to do this. But I'd like to start with the meditation. Take it from a different angle, the meditation practice, and then we'll get back to the five faculties. This is not going to be a very long sitting. It's more like an exercise. So gently close your eyes and see if you can, if possible, let go of any ideas you have of what meditation's about or what you're supposed to do, following your breath or anything at all. And just kind of be here in a kind of as fresh way as you can, just here. And as simply as you can, with as much simplicity of mind as you can, recognize what is your experience right now. Something comes to awareness, the sound of the heater, my voice, your body sensations, a thought, a feeling, something will come to awareness if awareness is open. And then as simply as you can, without any complicated analysis at all, let there be a recognition of what has come into awareness. And over time, different things will come into awareness. And so then, in the same pace that things arise in awareness, let there be the simple recognition of what that is. Because this looks a little bit like mindfulness practice, be very careful that old habits of how to practice don't kind of sneak in. Keep it really simple. Don't try to make yourself feel differently or calm or concentrated. Rather, maintain a steady stream of simple recognition of the present moment. If you hear a sound of a car, for example, you don't have to figure out what kind of car it is. Just recognize the raw experience of rumbling. Recognize the immediacy, how the felt sense is, what it feels like at the sense doors to feel or sense or hear or taste whatever's going on. You don't have to understand anything out there in the world. Just the sensory quality of what your experience is. Now I'd like you to continue just very simple recognition, but I would like to see if you can find or notice the nature of the recognizing mind, that activity of recognition. Can you notice or can you find a way of doing it where it is peaceful to recognize? You're not in conflict with anything. You're at ease. Maybe even a kind of feeling of stillness in the mind. Continue with the recognition of things as they arise, but begin tuning in to what the recognizing mind feels like in its simplicity. And then see if you can notice the degree to which the simple recognition of something, recognizing a sound, a thought, or feeling, a sensation, that the recognition in and of itself is independent of what's being recognized. And if you're able to discern how the recognizing mind is independent of what it recognizes, Can you then also see that the recognizing mind is peaceful or light, at ease? And now you might look around in your experience, your physical experience, and recognize, find what is in your experience is most uncomfortable for you. What's the most unpleasant or uncomfortable experience right now? Your knees or your back or your... It doesn't have to be very uncomfortable, but is there something which is uncomfortable? A feeling, an emotion? And then see if you can bring to bear to that experience, or to bring to that experience, a very simple recognition of that experience. And while you do that, appreciate the peaceful, independent quality of the recognizing mind. So now I wonder if what I was trying to point to was understandable by some of you. What did you notice about the quality of recognition, the quality of the mind that recognizes what's happening? Yes, Holly.
Well, at first it was easy to kind of float in sensation, and then as soon as I recognized I was doing that, it was like a thought. And it kind of pulled me away from it a little bit, and then you go back in. But then as soon as you said, what's the most unpleasant part of this? And I thought, I want to go home, I got all these things to do, and I was totally sucked into that, and I was gone for 30 seconds. And then I just came back.
And the bell rang. So when you're able to connect to... Okay, good. Thank you. Someone else?
What I recognize is that I can be very stressed and very calm at the same time. That my mind is really calm, but there's a racy quality, kind of overstimulated racy at once. Uh-huh. I used to think when I was stressed, my mind was very agitated.
Probably it was.
Probably. I don't think it is right now.
Right. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
Stress can be the result of karmic accumulation. That's, you know, still has momentum is still being carried on. But sometimes the mind can be very peaceful in the middle of it. So did some of you get a sense of some appreciation of the peacefulness of recognition? Is that something that made sense?
You know, one of the things I noticed is that I could recognize something without putting a name to it.
Okay, good.
You know, where there was, like, adding the name to it was adding to the experience as opposed to just being with the experience. Uh-huh. And it was a real interesting thing to realize that I recognized something without
putting a name on it.
Attaching a word.
Uh-huh. And if you turn the attention around, that recognizing, that nonverbal recognition, as it is for you, did you get a sense of it being independent of what you're experiencing? Is that something that made sense to you? Or did some of it not make sense? I expect that, you know, maybe a lot of you won't understand this. Yes, yeah, Pesha.
I'm thinking that my mind is peaceful because the things I'm experiencing are not scary.
Ah.
But what if I was experiencing terrible pain in my
right.
chest, the pressure, you know, having a heart attack? Then my recognizing mind would not be peaceful.
That's why one of the last exercise was find something uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And because what I want you to do, because it's possible to have something terrible happen to you, and the recognizing mind is a refuge of peace because it's independent. It's like an island. That's the classic analogy is an island that's above the floods. The flood of fear and desire and hate and all those things. And so the independent mind that recognizes, that sees clearly, is doesn't have to be pulled in to all the reactivity we have. Now, most people think that their reactivity and their mind are the same thing. But what we're doing with mindfulness practice, one of the things you can do with mindfulness practice is begin to learn that there's a power of observation, a power of recognition, which helps you become independent, distinct from the world of attachment, the world of fear, the world of, you know, sensations, the world, you know. And that quality of recognition that's independent is also a place of being is being peaceful.
So even in the midst of turmoil, I just recognize, it's like accepted.
Right. It can be like...
Be out of the drama.
It can be, yes, exactly. And see, most people are so focused on what they're aware of that they're caught up in the world of stress. But if you're able to turn the attention backwards to notice the other half of the equation, which is the nature of the awareness itself, you might notice that you might be able to develop that independent quality of awareness. And that's what happens naturally, I think, as mindfulness gets stronger. Mindfulness is like a muscle that gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And when that muscle is really strong, it feels like it's, you know, you know, it's going to be independent of no matter what happens to you. I mean, many of you have probably had that experience where you've done some meditation and you've gone into a situation where normally you would be reactive, but you're not reactive. And when the mindfulness gets very strong, then there's a sense of being independent from things around us. So someone can, you know, say, you know, I don't like people who wear glasses. You know, who's he to say? You know, it just doesn't have any effect on you, right? And but you know, so it can be much more serious. Mm-hmm. And so to have that as a refuge is can be very helpful in life, rather than being caught up. The reason why, yes, please.
To me, it sounded like the mind isn't like a camera, and it's sort of independent. It can take the pictures, but it's not all wrapped up. There's no real relationship between the camera and
great.
That which is being photographed.
That's nice. Great. In the early Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of talk about cultivating independence. The word is not independence, but probably it's a better, good translation to English. Usually translating to English is seclusion. The mind becomes secluded. But that's a little bit odd in English. But it works very well in America to say the mind becomes independent. The word is viveka. I think that message doesn't often get across very much here in the West because we put a lot of emphasis on interdependence, discovering how everything is interconnected in meditation. You see some of the Dharma books, and there's, you know, every page emphasizes the importance of finding interconnectedness. And that's a very profound Dharma of interconnectedness. But for meditation practice, the deepening of the meditation practice, we're also looking for a certain level of independence or seclusion or separation of that part of the mind that can see and recognize what's going on from what's being recognized. Hopefully this makes some sense. Holly.
I think I was attracted to my extreme work. And I was thinking maybe a lot of people are paramedics and, you know, life-threatening skiing and stuff, because at least for me, I'm so overwhelmed that I end up almost like dropping into my body, suddenly being completely present and just sort of being there. But it's an exhausting way to be present. And, I could use some Kleenex in my pants and run through the washing machine and I'm gone.
So the reason I wanted to teach about this today, try to get this across, is twofold. One is that I think it's a very important principle of mindfulness practice, and to appreciate this aspect of mindfulness. The appreciation of recognizing and seeing things that not seen before can help those things. Knowing how the mind works, knowing the nature of the mind, can help. That knowledge can help support the deepening of meditation practice. So by pointing something out, hopefully now you can recognize this in yourself, and in recognizing this is one of the things going on, it can help you not be so caught up in your experience, because you can pull back into recognition is not caught, it's free. Another reason why I wanted to say this today is that last week and this week, we're talking about tracking, noticing what goes on in meditation, noticing the process of meditation, what happens to you meditation-wise as you're doing meditation. It's a kind of a tracking process. And some people get wound up in themselves and they start tracking too much. And they get very busy and they get upset or they get judgmental or whatever. And I want you to keep doing the tracking. But in order to track, you have to recognize. And if you have some sense that recognition can be done peacefully, then perhaps the tracking won't be a burden. So... Yes, please.
So I was into experiencing, and then I observed myself experiencing, and I kind of separated myself from experience, and I became an observer. And then I was judging myself. So I would like to recognize when I do that at that moment from where I separate more. And I think that's part of what you're talking about tonight, is recognizing that moment of really being into experience and observing the
experience.
And going back and forth is something.
You certainly can explore that. But you might, during the course of this class, emphasize more the observing, strengthen that. And if in the process of doing that you become judgmental, that is something you have to work with. And eventually you'll learn not to observe without being judgmental. But when you do become judgmental, there's a treasure right there. Because what you can do is you can bring, if you can clearly recognize that you're being judgmental, in the recognition itself, there is a little bit of freedom. So when you notice a judging, you don't have to feel, I'll only be free when I get rid of the judging. If you can recognize, clearly recognize the independence, or the freedom, or the peacefulness of the recognition itself, right there you'll find some relief. Does that make some sense? Is it making some sense to people?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
I'm reminded just now to my question that I was going to ask you the difference between infinite mind and body sensation. For example, as things came up, I tended to feel the sounds more of body sensation would come up and I would see that. And you're saying they're not one and the same.
They're not one and the same. The recognition of the body sensation is not the body sensation. A very important part of Buddhist practice, of mindfulness practice, is to be embodied and to be very, in a sense, very intimate with your bodily experience, very kind of in it, in a sense. But but the recognition of the sensation is different from the sensation. And the deepening of vipassana practice comes not just, you know, if a person's only trying to kind of be in the experience, resting in it, that's a very powerful practice. But there's a kind of, from the point of view of vipassana, it becomes kind of a dead end. And what you need to do, at some point you need to develop is the strengthening, that recognizing quality, which is, in a sense, independent from what's being recognized. So there's two qualities going on at the same time. There's an intimacy part. You don't want to be aloof from your experience. You want to really feel embodied. But there's also the independent recognition of this is what's happening now. Does that make some sense? So, yes.
I found that this morning when I was meditating that I was able to much more easily do this kind of exercise. And I was aware tonight that it felt like I was kind of seeing or experiencing what came up sort of through a fog or something.
Sure.
This morning I was certainly much more rested. But I also had spent a bit of time initially getting not super, but somewhat concentrated. So when I would notice sounds or sensations or whatever, it was very vivid, but it was quite momentary. And where tonight it was, you know. But that's tonight. The fogginess is maybe how I seems like how I see things day to day more often, because something might be going on, and I'll remind myself, okay, I can be mindful now. But it's really hard to really be there very much.
Right.
I get quickly caught back into what's going on. And lose any notion of mindfulness at that point. So I'm not sure how to hold on to that at those more elusive times. The concentrated stage seems easy enough because it was just happens as a natural.
Right,
outcome.
Right. The well, it's possible to be cloudy and not have very much mindfulness or motivation and kind of be kind of in the fog with when you sit down to meditate sometimes. And then have a moment where you recognize that that's what's going on. And it's possible to have that recognition be clear enough that you find, at least for that moment, you find a kind of peacefulness or the independence, the freedom in that recognition of what's going on. As opposed to another way you could be, like, oh shoot, you know, how can I be so foggy? This is impossible. And, you know, why am I meditating before I have my coffee? And, you know, you can be caught up in your reactivity. But it's possible, even in very chaotic or dull states, to have at least a moment where you bring mindfulness to bear and the mindfulness helps you be independent of it. Then you get pulled right back in. So,
Is the mindfulness recognizing the mind the same thing?
I would say for today, I would say they're the same. I mean, it's a little bit complex, but for now, I'd say the same. I'd like to go on because we don't have so much time and I have a lot. This was supposed to be sort of kind of the warm up for the class today. So probably many of you have heard this analogy that I've given before, and that is the mindfulness or the ability to recognize clearly what's happening while it's happening. Can be compared to the developing and sharpening that ability to be mindful can be compared to sharpening a knife. Where if you're sharpening a knife, the knife doesn't particularly care. Don't push the analogy, but the knife doesn't care which whetstone it's used to get sharpened. It's quite promiscuous. You can take it to your friend's whetstone and sharpen it, and then, you know, down the street some other person's whetstone and keep sharpening it. And it doesn't really care. The knife gets sharper and sharper. Mindfulness doesn't care what experience is being used for the sharpening of mindfulness. So it can be your neighbor's dog barking. It can be an itch on your nose. It can be a horrible fantasy in your mind. It can be, you know, anything at all. And any experience you're having can be the whetstone for mindfulness. Now, what happens, I believe, for a number of people is that they look at their experience they're having, and that this is bad, this is good, and they judge it, and they relate to it. They're caught up in the world of their experiences. My meditation is successful if I get more calm, if I get more joy, if I get certain things, certain experience. But one way of understanding mindfulness is it doesn't really matter one iota what your so-called experience is in meditation. And in fact, some people are experience junkies. They're looking for the right experience. And they come to the teacher and they want to get validated for their experience. Mindfulness is not so much about the experience you have in meditation as you're using whatever experience you happen to have as a sharpening stone for mindfulness, for this recognizing quality. So it becomes a real strength within you. Does that make sense? So I say that so that, again, as partly as I tried to say last week, is we want to start taking into account in our meditation practice the subjective experiences that are being developed in the process of meditation. And one of the things that's being developed is mindfulness itself. The other things, there is a list of something called the five faculties. And these five faculties are five different psychological qualities that get developed together with mindfulness, that support mindfulness and come in the wake of stronger and stronger mindfulness. And one of the things we want to track in meditation practice, to some degree, you don't want to tie yourself in knots looking for this, but you want to be able to track these five faculties. Because they come into play as you do the meditation. And the five faculties are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, or discernment, as we talked about on Monday. And traditionally in Asia, the Vipassana teachers I studied with, a number of them, it was commonly understood that we're using the five faculties as their guide in guiding the students they were working with. So you would come to them, and they wouldn't tell you this explicitly, but they'd be listening to you, to your report of your meditation, how it's going, to listen to see where is there an imbalance in the five faculties? Which of the five faculties is weak and needs developing? Which is too strong and needs kind of calming down a little bit? And so they would listen for this, and then they say, you should do more X and Y in order to develop more energy or do this and that. Rather than having the teacher kind of use this to monitor your meditation, you can also do this for yourself. You can learn the principle of the five faculties and use that hopefully in a wise way, in a way that doesn't make you agitated or anxious or judgmental, but in a way that's helpful to further your cultivation of mindfulness, of concentration, of stillness. So faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, discernment. These are called Indriya, is the Pali word. And Indriya is, Indra is the god, one of the gods of ancient India, one of the great gods. It's supposed to mean kind of like Lord. And using this word Indriya for the five faculties, it's those faculties of the mind which help control the mind, help control the meditative mind. So the idea of developing mastery, mastering the mind, you have to have certain strengths in the mind in order to master the mind. So the five faculties, the word faculty in English is such a kind of, I don't know, it's such a lightweight word compared to the Pali word Indriya, which means more like the five, the kind of that which controls. So I've seen a translation, the controlling faculties. The reason why it's called faculties is that for most of us, they're not developed to the degree they can be developed. And so there are faculties we have, the potentials we have, that get developed as we develop meditation practice, until such a point as they become what's called powers, the five powers. So as you're meditating, what is the degree of faith or inspiration or confidence that you have? And you can track that. And you can notice over a week or over some time that the degree of faith or inspiration or enthusiasm or confidence or conviction that you have for your practice can vary. It can go up and down. And it's something you can tune up, something you can strengthen and enhance, the faith factor. You read a book that's really inspiring, you sit down to meditate, and there's a lot of faith. You're filled with faith. Or you meet, you know, you meet some really inspiring teacher, and you say, wow. And you have all this faith, and you sit down to meditate and say, wow. And you have all this faith for your practice, and you feel qualitatively different, the meditation practice, because of the strength of that faith and inspiration. You can, in the opposite way, you can be filled with doubt. You can doubt the practice, you can doubt your abilities, you can have all this doubt, and it becomes such a hindrance. It's one of the hindrances, doubt, that gets in the way of really kind of being engaged in a wholehearted way in practice. If you want to be wholeheartedly engaged, faith is a very important element. Energy is one of the things you were supposed to track last week. It can vary how much energy you have for the practice. But energy, you don't have to kind of be passive about energy. Energy is something you can add into the practice. You can feed energy into it. You can apply yourself more fully. You can endeavor more. You can make more effort. You can, like if you use the mental noting, you can start using mental note faster, make more mental notes. That's being more energetic if you need more energy in the practice. If you're too energized, if you're restless, maybe what you want to do is do slower mental notes, very slow and easygoing mental notes. It's a way of modulating, bringing balance. Concentration. You can develop your concentration. Concentration and calm are almost synonymous. So you can develop your concentration and your calm. You don't have to just take for granted the level of concentration and calm you have when you sit down. But you can actually practice in such a way that you develop greater concentration if you feel like you need that. And then discernment, wisdom. To be able to be discerning about what you see, to discern clearly distinctions between things, clear discernment of what's happening, discernment of what is helpful and not helpful in your practice, what is skillful and not helpful, to have insight into what's actually happening in your experience, to have some understanding and knowledge about how the meditative process works, what the principles of meditation are. All these things can be cultivated and called upon and evoked. And as you're tracking this, you might find you're sitting down to meditate and you're kind of lackadaisical one day. You're not really motivated very much. And you say, oh, the faith factor is not there much, or the effort factor is not there. I'm not making much effort. Often enough, at the end of one of my sittings, I might review that sitting and I notice, well, you know, that was nice, but, you know, I could have made more effort. Even without striving or pushing or exerting myself in a kind of stressful way, I could have easily been much more engaged in my mindfulness practice at last sitting. I kind of was too, you know, easygoing there, you know, and, you know, I could have upped it a little bit. And I don't beat myself up for that, but it's a valuable recognition. Next time I sit, hopefully then I'll bring that memory of that. So, oh, let's remember. I sometimes don't put myself into the meditation as fully as I could. I don't give myself over to it as much as I could. What if I really give myself over to this? Give yourself over to the practice. Put more effort into it. So the five controlling faculties are there in the background of the mind when you're doing mindfulness practice. So say you're following your breath. So you're really trying to be with your breath. The five faculties affect the quality of that attention on the breath. Faith. If you don't have any faith in what you're doing, the mind's going to go to where it does have faith. And maybe you have faith, you know, what do you have faith in? The stock market. So your mind goes thinking about, or maybe lunch. So you have a lot of faith in food. So your mind goes off thinking about food. That's where your faith really is. But if you don't have faith, you know, the mind's not going to want to stay there. You don't have confidence or conviction or inspiration. You're trying to stay with the breath. And you notice that you're not really making much effort. I've known people who have kind of a magical approach to meditation practice. They feel like if they just put in their time on the cushion, that sooner or later something will happen. And they're very passive about it. And their mind just wanders freely, and just whatever happens is fine. And there's hardly any effort being applied. Effort is something we can apply. We can apply the mind. You know, for the concentration class some of you took in the spring, I asked you to memorize something. And the exercise of memorizing something is very interesting, because in order to memorize something, you have to apply energy. Without energy, application of energy, you're not going to memorize. And that the kind of energy you have to apply to memorize something is very closely akin to the kind of energy you need to apply to be really mindful on top of your experience as it's happening. To be engaged, involved, active in your meditation practice. That's really the theme, one of the themes for this four-week class, is emphasizing the active side of meditation here. Later you can go back to the passive side, but here's the active side. You can cultivate greater mindfulness. You can just focus on recognizing more closely. Look more carefully. Be more continuous in your mindfulness. Mindfulness can be stronger both in terms of greater penetration, greater seeing clearly what's going on in the moment, and can become stronger in maintaining a continuity of mindfulness over time. And then you can have concentration. Concentration is this zeroing and this being composed on the experience, being composed in what's happening. I love the word being composed, because composure is something you do with your whole body. You compose yourself. If you want to become more concentrated, how can you become more composed on this experience you're having right now? Composed with the body, and composed with your feelings, and composed with the focus of your mind. To have greater focus. So sometimes if you're sitting down following your breath, and you feel like you're making good effort, and you're relatively mindful, but the mind is still somewhat scattered for whatever reason, maybe what you need to do is cultivate greater concentration. And so you relate to the breath in a way that is conducive to create greater concentration. Maybe you count the breath. Maybe you choose one point in the sensations of the breathing and just focus on that one point where you can feel the arising and passing of the breath, and you hang on to it with the mind. You're not going to let the mind waver from that one-pointed experience. Or there's other ways of developing concentration. Or perhaps you feel that you're not being very discerning in your meditation. You can be with the breath, you're somewhat concentrated, you're calm, you're present, but it's kind of like a dead-end calm. You've been calm for a long time, and you're pretty mindful of what's there. Maybe what you need to do now is be more discerning of what your experience of the breath is, and more discerning of the other factors of the mind that are coming into play when you're with the experience of the breath. It's said that faith and wisdom are important to be balanced. They balance each other. If you have too much discernment, too much wisdom, too much understanding, it leads to an imbalance of being too much in your head. If you have too much faith, it can be blind faith. And it can lead to a certain kind of passivity sometimes, or a certain kind of zealotry, which is unhealthy. It said that energy and concentration need to be balanced. If you find yourself with a lot of energy someday when you sit down to meditate, you don't have to simply accept that that's the way it's going to be. You can try to calm the excessive energy by cultivating concentration. If you feel that you're really calm, but too calm, so you can't really, you're not getting sunk kind of in a foggy well of too much calm, then what you want to do is bring up more energy. Bring more energy into the practice. It can be more mental energy by applying yourself more in the mindfulness practice. It can be physical energy by sitting up straighter. or by getting up and doing walking meditation, or do standing meditation. Anything that brings more energy into the whole system, so you more so the calm and the energy are balanced. Pesha.
You mentioned you're too agitated. That is my problem when I sit down. Focus on the concentration on what? On all the stuff that's going on?
There's a wide variety of choices of what you can do. And what you should do, what I recommend is you experiment.
Yeah, I have.
And if you some people find it very helpful to concentrate directly on the experience you're having. Mm-hmm. So concentrate on the agitation, for example. But if that's not being helpful, the classic thing to do is to go back to your breathing and develop concentration. Just let the breath help calm you down.
I just found that feels like I'm fighting two parts of my mind. So in this week, I experimented quite a bit, and I felt if I let the mind run the first, I don't know, 10, 15, I don't know how many minutes, if like I feed it, okay, and then the mind can calm down. Then I can go into concentration.
Great, that's lovely. To see that, to understand that pattern of yours is great. That the mind has natural ability to quiet down in its own good time, if you just give it its freedom and leave it alone, and don't get more agitated because your mind is agitated, and that's a really wise pattern. And so you're using that, you're using your understanding of how your mind unfolds in your favor, and then maybe after 10 minutes, you're settled enough, you're no longer agitated, and then you're ready to apply yourself in a different way in mindfulness. And then, okay, now I'm ready to start. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's go. I've had the same pattern at times in my own practice. And I didn't want to tell Upandita because, you know, I was just kind of, I found it very helpful to be kind of less, you know, kind of very easygoing and let the mind kind of very free, 5 or 10 minutes. And then once that helped it calm down. Mm-hmm. And then I got, you know, into the practice in a much more serious way. So the five faculties. There are a lot of teachings on the five faculties, and probably some of you have heard these teachings before. One way of understanding it is linearly, where they follow each other. That practice begins with some level of conviction or faith, and then based on that faith, a person then is inspired to make energy. And as they apply themselves energetically, then they become more mindful. And as they become more mindful, the mindfulness becomes more continuous, and the continuity of mindfulness helps bring up concentration. And the concentrated mind which is concentrated and mindful tends to be much more discerning and cultivates greater wisdom. So there's kind of a linear approach to it. I think the more useful way is to see it as being... that's one way, useful way of seeing. But as you do your meditation for the next week, I would like you to begin exploring the five faculties and how they play themselves out in your meditation practice. In the same way that some of these faculties you are tracking in the homework for this last week. So it's continuing in that line. But faith, really look at faith. Faith is closely connected to the other assignment from last week, which is to look at the purpose for which you do meditation practice. It's really important to have a really clear sense of purpose. And with a clear sense of purpose, how much conviction do you have that it's worthwhile to pursue that purpose? And that level of conviction can vary quite widely. And what can you do to arouse a greater sense of conviction, of faith or inspiration, that this is worthwhile doing? Yes, I'm going to do it. So you can be more wholehearted in the practice you're going to do. What can you do to bring up greater energy, greater sense of really applying yourself in the practice, a greater degree of applying yourself without getting tied up in yourself, without straining and getting kind of, you know, caught up in excessive energy? What can you do to bring more mindfulness? Don't you simply accept mindfulness at the degree that it is when you sit down? Can you augment the mindfulness? Don't you simply accept the degree of concentration you have when you sit down? Maybe it's appropriate for you to augment the concentration. Try to develop more concentration. How discerning are you in your meditation practice? Can you be more discerning about what your experience is? Can you be more discerning about what's useful to do in meditation and what's not useful to do? Can you be more discerning about, you know, what your mind is doing? Can you be discerning about the other four qualities, the other four faculties? Some of you might want to spend more time to being more, in a sense, more passive about this, simply recognizing how the faculties are playing themselves out in the practice. And maybe that's all you need to do, just recognize, oh, today effort was at a 2 or a 7 or something. But what I'd like you to try to do during this next week, during part of the sitting, is to see what you can do, experiment with trying to elevate, strengthen the five faculties so they're more present in a way that they would otherwise be. You might trip over yourself a little bit doing this. Don't be afraid of that. You know, it might be, it's like you have to fall off the bicycle a few times before you can learn to ride the bicycle. But really try, apply yourself and see what can you do. Is this making some sense? If it doesn't make sense, this is the time to ask questions. Please. Yes, Connie.
Yes, I'm just thinking about the independent mind.
Yeah.
Tracking of the elevating of the five faculties. How does that work?
One of the reasons I wanted to, you to emphasize, one of the reasons I wanted to emphasize the independent recognizing quality of the mind is that as you do this tracking, I wanted that the tracking itself can be done with that recognizing mind. So you're always sharpening the knife and the whetstone. So you notice, faith is not so strong right now. The recognition of weak faith is itself satisfying, because right there is finding a little bit of freedom. As opposed to, oh, the faith is weak, and it's supposed to be stronger, and I'm supposed to make it stronger. Gil tells me that, and I don't know how to do it, and I better not tell him next week. It's embarrassing, and pretty soon we're lost, right, in this world. But right there, in the recognizing you have weak faith, right there is, in a sense, the fulfillment of the practice. So I tried to teach that at the beginning of the class to help prevent, as a safeguard, from getting all tongue-tied or all mind-tied or something by doing this tracking. Everything, any experience we have, including the experience of the five faculties, is a whetstone for mindfulness. Yes?
Isn't that you are applying these five faculties in any aspect of our life? Being a mother, being a father, whatever.
You got it, yes. So she pointed out, aren't these five faculties, don't they play themselves out in any activity in life, not just meditation? And absolutely, it's very interesting to look and use these five qualities to look at your experience in daily life. You need more energy. You're sitting in your office, in your cubicle, and you're getting more and more lethargic. You need more energy. do something. Need more concentration, whatever. Yes?
You were mentioning some examples just now of recognizing the mind, recognizing that they have a lot of faith, and then, and you start getting lost and saying, well, I should become more confident. But my confusion is, isn't that what has to precede the effort to cultivate more faith, which is another part of the homework? In other words, the homework is either you recognize it or you recognize and say, okay, let's see if I can add more to it or strengthen it. But preceding that feeling or the effort you have to start thinking, I need more of this skill set, I need more of this now. Let's see, what should I do to make more of this? Right. I think that's going on in your mind as well.
Yeah. Yeah, little bit like that's going on. So don't be afraid of little bit like that. But if you find yourself getting tied up in knots, but then forget it for a while. But see if you can do this exercise as simply and innocently as possible. So it's not, if you're beginning to kind of create this big engineering project of how to get more faith, more energy, forget it. But if, you know, if you're sitting there kind of meditating and you feel, you know, I think I need more energy, and then you kind of just sit up straighter, maybe that's all you need to do. Or maybe you kind of apply the mental focus on the breath more sharply, more energetically, you have greater application. Okay, I'm really going to be there with that breath. There's ways of bringing up more energy, more application. And hopefully it's a very simple thing. But this is what I want you to experiment with for the next week. Can you, in a healthy and useful way, in a wise way, not just simply take the level at which you find the five faculties for granted. Did I say that? Okay. Don't just take it for granted, the level they're at. But notice the level they're at, and then see if you can develop them, strengthen them. If you feel that they're imbalanced, can you bring them into balance by strengthening one or weakening the other? You can have too much energy, so sometimes you need to kind of relax the energy level. So, you know, it's kind of like finding your way a little bit and balancing these things. Does that make sense?
But I would like to ask you, what is the difference between mindfulness and just the same thing?
Mindfulness and concentration are different. Mindfulness is recognizing, for right now, I'll simply say mindfulness is recognizing what experiences you're having. Concentration is just simply focusing on the experience. If the camera analogy, if you're concentrating on the tree you're taking a picture of, you're holding the camera very, very steady. But you're not really mindful until you've registered the image on your film. And you really clearly, now you really registered what's there. And you need to have you need to hold the camera really still in order to get a clear photo. So the recognition is different from the steady hold, steady gaze of attention. Yeah.
This categorization, where did it come from?
The five faculties?
Yeah.
From the Buddha. And he might have got it from someone else, but we don't know. He didn't tell us.
And if I wanted to read about this, where would I go?
Oh, a number of the Vipassana books talk about the five faculties. Probably if you look in Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, there's probably a very nice discussion of it there. There's a little discussion of it in Tanissara Bhikkhu's book, The Wings of Awakening, which I think is for free out there on the table. It's a big blue book. He has a whole little section on the wings, where he on the faculties, where he has a lot of sutta quotations where he talk about the five faculties. But look at Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. Yes?
You didn't say much about wisdom.
What's that all about? I'm going to give a talk. I'm planning to give a talk on wisdom on Sunday. Last Monday, we kind of began the discussion about it. Wisdom means various things, but I think the key element, the key aspect of wisdom is it's some people call it discriminating wisdom. It's the ability to make distinctions and connections between things. It's discernment, to be discerning about what the experience is. If your meditation, and there's different elements of that discernment, if your meditation practice has a purpose, maybe it doesn't have to be, but if it has a purpose, then wisdom is that discernment that knows how to pursue that purpose in a useful way. So you have to have some discernment about how to be with your experience for the purposes of developing or moving towards that purpose. So discernment, the wisdom is that knowledge, that understanding, that discernment. Another aspect of discernment is discerning very clearly the nature of the experience you're having, the underlying qualities, the characteristics of that experience. Another aspect of discernment is just having some general understanding of the principles of meditation and the principles of spirituality so that your faith is not imbalanced. So that, for example, I like to think of the Kalama Sutta as being a very important aspect of Buddhist wisdom. The Kalama Sutta is a very famous little discourse of the Buddha where he says, don't believe things on faith, basically. But rather, through your own experience, through your own ability to discern what is useful and unuseful, what is helpful and not helpful in your experience, find your own way. So discernment is that ability. We're not taking things on blind faith, but you're relying on your own powers of observation, of intelligence, of clear observation, of understanding the principles. It's a whole wide, wisdom is a wide body of human capacity. So what it means to have greater wisdom when you sit and meditate for this next week, greater discernment, I would suggest it means greater discernment about how to proceed in your meditation practice in a wise way. So don't just simply sit there and kind of be passive and say, I'm going to follow my breath. That's not very discerning. Rather, try following your breath and notice, when I'm there with the breath, at the end of the exhalation, that's where my mind tends to wander off into thought. Oh, and you discern that, you see that. What if I give a little bit more extra effort at the end of the exhalation so I can hang in there until the beginning of the next inhalation? So you discern, you've noticed what's going on there, and you're able to make that little correction or that little extra effort in the practice because of what you've noticed. So you get you through the end of the exhalation without getting lost in thought, because that's where. So what I'm suggesting here is wisdom means greater discernment about the process of meditation itself. Is that helpful? Distinction is an aspect of discernment. Discernment involves being able to make distinctions and connections between things. So, for example, being able to distinguish. So if you have like a physical pain, the pain in your knee, to be discerning about that pain is to be able to distinguish different strands of that experience and be able to distinguish between the physical experience and the mental reactivity, often which are quite intertwined for people. To be able to make fine distinctions. So, and also like tracking the meditation over the week, to make a distinction between the degree of motivation on Tuesday versus the degree of motivation on Wednesday, or the degree of motivation at the beginning of a sitting, at the end of the sitting. Beginning to make distinctions, and those distinctions inform how we're going to continue practicing. So for example, I've sat down to meditate, and I've had a fair amount of strong motivation and energy when I first started sitting, and things were going along just fine until a while where something was going on, and then at some point I noticed, I'm not really applying myself very much here. I don't have much, the faith element is not very strong for me, and there's not much application here compared to what it was earlier. And in that contrast, that distinction, and then I start looking more carefully, what's going on here? And then I might notice, I'm actually uncomfortable. And what my mind does when it gets uncomfortable, it begins to zone out. I made that connection, and then I said, next time I feel uncomfortable, rather than zoning out, I'm going to experiment with zeroing in on the pain, just looking at head on, looking it in the eye. And then I'm going to notice the results of doing that. When I do that, then my mindfulness, my energy, my faith stays aroused, stays continuous. So there's a tracking process in the meditation practice. And the wisdom aspect is that which tracks, that which discerns what's going on. Okay? Yes, Bill.
This may be semantic, but it has a fairly deep meaning for me. It's quite simple to apply more energy. I mean, there's mental energy, there's physical energy. Mindfulness is you're there. If you're not there, you can pull yourself back in to a certain extent. Getting calmer is, you know, I understand all of these things. Even the idea of wisdom is, presumably that's what we do when we come in ignorant, and hopefully at the other end there's a certain amount of wisdom achieved.
Or is it more discerning?
Yeah. But faith is either is or isn't. You either have faith or you don't. The reason that I no longer attend any Christian church is that I woke up one day and realized that I had no faith in all that they had taught me in the last 4 years. And I said, this is a waste of my time, and I stood up and I walked away. So the concept to me of, if there's not any faith there, getting some, is just about as alien as saying, oh, I'm not happy here, I should go to the moon.
I understand what you're saying, and I might not. Hopefully, it's responsive to what you're saying. I've noticed here in the West that the word faith is a really difficult word for a lot of people because it has very strong association, very strong meanings in the Judeo-Christian traditions, where their faith traditions, where believing certain tenets is really important. Buddhism is not a Judeo-Christian tradition, not yet at least. It will in a few more decades. But faith is not... I think it'd be more useful to think of faith as being a conviction or confidence. Do you have confidence in the practice? Do you have confidence in your ability to apply yourself? And I notice in myself, even after all these years, that my confidence level varies from day to day a little bit, or from week to week. Sometimes I feel very confident. Oh yeah, I can do this. Let's go. And I can do. You know, I'll sit here. You know, I'm exaggerating a little bit now, but you know, I'm really confident. In this sitting, I can really kind of sit really strong and get concentrated and really be present. And other days, I sit down. My confidence level is not so strong. You know, I feel a little bit. I've been battered around by life a little bit, and I have. Who am I to be telling anyone how to be mindful? You know, I sit down and this, and so much confidence in myself or in the practice. So what I'm trying to do for you is make a distinction between a religious idea of having faith in certain tenets or not faith in certain tenets versus having confidence in a particular task, in a particular activity of meditation. And I think as a five faculties, perhaps the word sadha should be translated not as faith, but as confidence or conviction. So like, you know, if you were going to, you're a blacksmith. So I suspect that the degree of confidence you have in your ability to be a blacksmith from one day to the other, don't respond. But, could vary. You know, I don't feel very confident today. You know, and the other day you have a lot of confidence. So, does that make some sense?
Yeah, it's certainly the term faith as defined in the Oxford Dictionary doesn't apply to anything that I do here. So.
Oh, I see. Yes. Do you remember what that definition is?
I don't, but I...
Yeah, bring it next week. I'd like to see.
Because you know, I have a certain amount of understanding that this is the right place for me and what I should be doing right now, but it's not an overpowering faith. It's got something more to do with things feeling right.
Mm-hmm.
Direct experience.
Yeah.
So maybe the word should be heartfelt motivation. To what degree are you bringing heartfelt motivation? Can you bring a greater degree of heartfelt motivation when you do the practice? So for some of you, what you might do, if you want to experiment with enhancing your faith level, your inspiration level, maybe before you sit, if you have some Dharma book that's really meaningful for you, sit down and spend, you know, 5 or 10 minutes reading it. Or if you have, you know, if you have something which, you know, maybe figure of the Buddha or something that that tends to evoke for you a sense of faith, inspiration, greater heartfelt kind of enthusiasm for the practice, maybe before you meditate, you kind of connect yourself with that, so that that's what you bring with you, bring that with you into meditation practice. So there is, yes.
The thing about faith is really what to look at in terms of motivation. I know, I think it was like the 1992, I actually stopped sitting because I wasn't motivated. I didn't have a lot of faith, and I picked up in 1995, and I started this group again. And I realized it's really important to look at it. Some people even say to do it like once a day, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
But every once in a while, it's very important to review that and to look at that. Sometimes you get it skewed off, and you'll just sit every day, it broke, and it's not going to. People wonder why things aren't gelling, it's because they're not looking at what's motivating to sit.
And then it's also possible to have so much faith, you sit down, you're kind of sitting in a cloud of kind of joy and delight, but there's no discernment, no application. So please, when you sit down to meditate this week, the instructions around the five faculties are given in the homework assignment that you're supposed to be journaling about. And you're supposed to be sitting 45 minutes a day, and then at the end of the sitting, spend some time writing about the experience, and some guidelines for what to write about and how to practice in out there on the chair by the entryway there. And again, I counted how many people were here, and I think there's exactly enough for one per person. But I think I probably counted wrong. So if there are some of you who are here with a partner or something where it's easy for you to just take one and make a Xerox copy later, that would probably be helpful. Then we're sure to get, then we're...
Come out on email again.
Oh, Inez will do it out in email. Thank you. And what I'd hope this evening is, as some of you know, when I did the intro class, I'm always hoping to have more sitting as part of it, and that I always talk so much. And again, this just in character with that strategy, I was planning to have another sitting where we were going to actually sit with the five faculties, and I had this maybe delusions of grandeur that I could sit help you kind of focus on each of the five faculties and really kind of enhance them and really be present for them. So at the end of our sitting together, the room was just buzzing with energy and vitality and presence and stillness, and everyone's really resolved and grounded and really here and inspired and just doing this practice, you know, moment by moment, mindful and not missing a beat, and just, we're just beginning humming.
Now it has to be our homework.
But now it has to be your homework. Okay. That's different. That's from last week's homework. Mm-hmm. And if you found last week's homework useful, continue doing it. You don't have to stop doing it just because I've given you a new assignment. But there is a new assignment. But strength of occupation is a very important one. Preoccupation. Strength of preoccupation is how strongly are you caught up in your concerns, your mental concerns. So if... So, for example, if you're thinking about what you're going to have for dinner tonight, it might not be such a strong concern. You know, you can easily let go of it. But if say that you have this funny itch on your heel, and you suspect that it's cancer, you know, the strength of preoccupation is going to be much more than your concern about dinner, and so it's a lot easier to let go of it. So that's what I meant by strength of preoccupation. Now, in that last week's homework, you might want to review it, the sheet, because the list of those lists in the first half of it, they're paired intentionally. And calmness and alertness, preoccupation, letting go, motivation, enjoyment, sensitivity to the body and concentration, effort and quietness of mind. It's interesting, it might be interesting to go back and look at the numbers you put and compare those pairs and how they relate to each other. Or compare other pairs, other aspects, and see if you can find any correlation between, for example, what's the correlation between these different factors when they appear in meditation? When you're calm, you always have when you have a high degree of calm, is there usually a low degree of preoccupation? When there's a higher degree of alertness, is there usually a low degree of greater degree of letting go? Kind of experiment a little bit, play around with correlating these factors, see what you can learn about your what goes on in your own mind. Anyway, yes.
There's one other thing that I just found a little odd is that all of the you've got two lists here. You've got the five hindrances in the bottom list and the top list are these factors, and there's only one of them that's a negative, and that's strength of preoccupation. I wonder if there's a positive way to state that.
Ability to let go. I've said a lot. Remember, as you do your meditation practice, mindfulness is primarily a practice of seeing clearly what's going on in the present moment. And you can continue with your basic practice as you've always done it, being mindful of the breath, the body, feelings, of thoughts, just the way you usually do it. But as you do the regular practice, then in a way that seems right, and you have to experiment what feels right, add in these other exercises of starting to track also the five faculties and more of the five hindrances as it's going on there and as is described in the homework. And I look forward to hearing next week how it's going. And we'll see if we can all be buzzing. Thank you.